I'm a good portion of the technology building side of this. And I'd say you're more of the political motivation, ethics. This is why we're doing this. This is the problem that we see instead of doing this. Would you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely some overlap there, but
yeah. Yeah, Jared. So me and you talk quite a bit. And then the introduction of Logos, or the thought of how we, like how this thing gets built, you mentioned the concept of politics quite a bit and why this whole Logos thing has to be political. Can you kind of go over that a little bit as to like why does politics need to be involved in the creation of Logos or the creation of technology in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think like it depends on how far you back you really want to go and which thread you want to go down, right? So typically, there's kind of like two main threads that I would consider. One is sort of like the post 9/11 world, which kind of came into the post 9/11 world, where like you started to see these sort of mass surveillance programs come out, right? So I think it was like in roughly the early 2000s, maybe 2004, where like Thomas Tam and Thomas Drake were effectively like these whistleblowers that revealed Stellar Wind, which was this sort of one of the first sort of foundational dragnet surveillance spy operations against US citizens, right? And did mass data collection. You know, this continued or paved the sort of legal foundation for, you know, the Snowden revelations, which came out almost like what, 10, 12 years later, which was the NSA spy program PRISM. And that combined with, say, the Patriot Act basically gave the US carte blanche to collect all data and all people across the entire planet. And those things are still ongoing. Another side of that is perhaps, you know, around a similar sort of time, around sort of 2010, 2009, and 2011, the sort of rise of like, you know, the Occupy Bitcoin, in which I view both of those as a form of protest for economic freedom and against the sort of financial system or this sort of one, so-called 1%, as you would hear in the Bitcoin community, this notion of like debt slavery, right? Mm-hmm. Through inflation of fiat currency to the point where like your money and purchasing power is not like worth anything. So like, you know, one of the issues with that, well, one of the issues with say the surveillance side of things is that you end up getting into a position where like now all of this data is collected on you. You might be concerned about your privacy, right? But you know, one of the arguments against that might be saying, "Well, I've got nothing to hide," and that's like okay. But there's a broader problem there, and it's, you know, it can be, you know, one way to look at that is like how you could potentially be manipulated as a citizen, or how does that allow a democracy to function, right? You know, I think Glenn Greenwald kind of said something to the effect of, "Is like if I know every single thing about you, about what you think, how you reason, what your fears are, and like what you're planning, and even what you're doing, and you know nothing about me because I'm shielding my behavior behind like a wall of secrecy, then like I have a massive amount of power over you, and it's not just you, right? It's the entire population we're talking about. So this sort of power imbalance created by this sort of technological gap allows a very small minority to influence human behavior en masse. And like today we're starting to see that in like censorship of like big tech platforms or big tech platforms censoring individuals. And so this starts suppressing sort of political dissidents. Anyone who doesn't agree with like an official narrative. And say like, when it contrasting to say like Occupy and Bitcoin, even though they're fundamentally protesting a similar thing, you essentially are kind of well, you can view both Bitcoin and Occupy under sort of Albert Hirschman's notion of exit, voice, and loyalty, right? So Albert Hirschman had this sort of ultimatum that you can apply. He was using it for consumer products, but you could apply that with your relationship to the state. You can either be loyal to the system, like everything's fine. You can express your voice or discontent. That's like through protests. Or you can exit the system, which Bitcoin was trying to do by creating a new currency, essentially, that has better sort of foundational properties that support sort of economic freedom and has a different monetary policy that is supported by the people. So when it comes to, say, something like Logos, it's really sort of an instantiation of some of the things, ideas that like Ethereum got right in the early days, right? Like this notion of like decentralized applications. But they're typically trying to be sort of agnostic towards why this technology actually matters, right? It was more focused on a world computer. But there is actually really strong sort of political reasons why this matters. I don't know if you want to get into that, but like it's a whole other thing as well.
Yeah, that's this. There's this, like I want to get into this idea that eventually tech is neutral, but there's a politics associated with building it and a politics or ethics associated with using it. And those are different, but I like this. I want you to keep going with this concept of like why, where did Ethereum, where are the current blockchains failing? Because the whole, I got into this personally because of this removal of the human from the system in a lot of ways, right? Like removing the ability for people to take asymmetric power into the system or to need to trust someone such that they have this power in order to influence me or the larger group. And so you make these, I guess, incredibly neutral infrastructure for people to use and rely upon that isn't subject to human greed and power dynamics. Why are the projects that currently in existence don't give you this? Like why are they going bad? Why are they going in the wrong direction maybe?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say whether they're like going in a wrong direction, per se, like, but I think like one of the ways to view that is like, okay, there's a set of like rights, right, that I particularly care about. And that sort of subset is civil liberties. And civil liberties are usually around safeguarding against tyranny, right? So you're talking about things like, freedom of speech, like, and conversely, freedom of thought and freedom of press, the right to associate or freedom of assembly, economic freedom, and I also care about, say, self-determination, and there's a whole host of other ones, right? And when you start to look at like how some of the other approaches are upholding these, they tend to fail short. And there's pragmatic reasons for doing that as well, right? Like one of the often sort of excuses, I guess, is like this notion of scalability, right? It's like in the certain current designs that we've chosen because of historical reasons, the only way to kind of work with this existing design and move it forward is to make concessions on certain aspects, where I think that we can benefit from a lot of the learnings that happened over this space in that time and try to compose them and construct them in a way that has stronger guarantees when it comes to upholding certain civil liberties towards the individual or the users of the network.
Yeah, I think my talk at DEF CON kind of tried to point that out of like, we may have made decisions in the past that are making it difficult to move back in that direction now because we've tried to scale, like we've optimized for scale so much and reintroducing things like privacy, specifically in lower layers of the stack, is much harder because we've made those decisions a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of curious, like, why you think privacy at that sort of level of the stack is important?
The current, you can call it censorship, that happens with MEV and OFAC sanctioning that came as a consequence of Tornado Cash being sanctioned by the United States is a really good example here. It is a smart contracts or privacy built into smart contracts, specifically on Ethereum in this context, isn't guaranteed because the ability to censor those transactions and view the details of those transactions is available at lower layers before the smart contract execution even happens. So validators who are looking through these transactions and ordering them are able to picture like, oh, this is a Tornado Cash transaction. This person is involved with it and it's going to this person. Let's just not include it at all, right? So the privacy that you would get from the smart contract execution is completely negated by the lack of privacy in a lower level, right? So, and this is this broader idea that it's impossible to build private systems on top of unprivate systems in a lot of way, which is exactly what the internet has been trying to do for a long period of time with the introduction of encryption in transit. There's still a lot of metadata associated with those encrypted packets based on the routing of those packets and where they're going. And if you just drop them, then you've mitigated the whole privacy situation in the first place. And I think you need to reintroduce it earlier such that people can reveal themselves in the place in which they are trying to reveal themselves, as opposed to being constrained to a more narrow system at the lower levels.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I mean, the Tornado Cash incident definitely kind of spelled out some of the issues with our ideology on how we conceive, you know, blockchains, right? Like in Bitcoin, what was so amazing about it is it could secure value or even Bitcoin scripts or smart contracts in the case of Ethereum in a hostile environment. Yet now the response to Tornado Cash and, you know, led to new forms of attacks against these networks. And as you said, like in these sort of lower layers, that's where this coercive ability arises, right? So if you're able to identify the transactor, if you're able to identify the people, the nodes or the people who secure the network or participate in the network in any way, then you can coerce them. And if you can coerce them, as we saw in Tornado Cash, we started seeing, as you said, like these blocks not being relayed or being censored. And while there is enough distribution around the entire planet for different nodes, and like ultimately a lot of those transactions still made it into the chain, it's not hard to imagine a future scenario where one of those attacks is more complete, let's say. Say, for example, you know, the Financial Action Task Force, KYC AML, is largely implemented in like most countries. So you can imagine a similar thing happening on that front. But more importantly is that it undermines this notion of like neutrality in these networks. Like once you can coerce somebody in that system, you can undermine how that system behaves. And when it comes to why neutrality matters is because it's a prerequisite for a lot of these civil liberties, right? As soon as you have an intermediated experience, and that intermediator no longer agrees with the, say, speech that's going through it or the associations being made in it, they can have an opinion on that, which comes in the form of censorship.
Yeah, this is something. I locked my microphone for a second. Yeah, this is this bleeds into this next conversation. But to add to what you're just speaking about, like if you'd like to make a credibly neutral infrastructure for everyone to operate on, then it can't be subject to the bias of nation states. Like we're trying to build infrastructure for the world, and so the bias of nation states can't be below that infrastructure. So and that's the way it currently is, right? If the opinions of a given jurisdiction can influence the operation of the infrastructure the world uses to transact or congregate digitally, whether that be value or socially, like then we don't have that infrastructure inversion that we need. We need it. Right. We need it to be flipped such that the given jurisdictions operate on a common infrastructure and they're able to move around, but not influence the way in which the infrastructure operates. And that's the main, I think, point for me is that we haven't made that inversion of infrastructure yet. And because of that, you're able to see this situations like Tornado Cash where like, oh, we don't like this, so the whole thing doesn't work this way anymore. As opposed to this opt out, exit, or voice your opinion, right?
Yeah, I mean, and then once you start going down that line of thought, if we're talking about a system that is no longer biased by, say, nation states, then that's when you start getting into this notion of sovereignty of these networks. And this notion of like a new polity that could form around this sort of reframing of blockchains as a voluntarist social order, right? That's a whole other topic we can probably go into a bit. But like before we do, like it's not clear why like neutrality really matters, right? Particularly when it comes to, let's say, institutions or the operation of a network like this. And you know, you can certainly make arguments on sort of civil liberties grounds, but perhaps another clear recent example is like the weaponization of the US dollar, right? After World War II, the United States was in an amazing position for securing peace around the world. And consequently, like the US dollar also became basically the de facto world reserve currency for international trade because it could be secured. Yet, the sort of actions done by the US, both in terms of how they've, you know, printed their money, but also how they've effectively used that to police transactions around the world, say like economic sanctions on other nation states, is kind of useful to a certain extent if you have like large buy-in. But if you take it too far, then that institution or that, you know, that currency starts to lose value because it is no longer impartial. And so it no longer becomes a great store of value or a medium of exchange because you may get rugged at any point, effectively, right? Mm-hmm. So then you have, you know, say BRICS now forming around the Chinese yuan. And I don't necessarily agree with that being a better currency, but you've kind of lost this position or this capacity for different nation states in an anarcho society to be able to trustlessly transact between each other in a secure fashion, which then leads to a whole other host of issues in terms of financial trade. So if you could create, say, a currency that is, say, politically neutral, has all the properties of sound money, including fungibility, which is where privacy also comes in, then you effectively create an institution that is valuable for everybody. But then if you're doing it in a system like we are, then you can expand the scope of that to almost any institution that can be represented by, say, a smart contract or a policy that is running on chain, which is going to be tremendous in terms of unlocking value for anyone who wants to be involved in that system.
Yeah, this is the thing that this part interests me really a lot, and that is tech neutral? Like, is the underlying technology neutral, or is technology in general neutral? And this argument of like the ethics of building technology is like, more often than not, when people hear about the kind of work that we do and that we have a strong focus on privacy and we are mitigating or keeping out current people's ability to identify illicit finance by adding privacy in lower layers of the stack, they ask me like, you're enabling a lot of bad actors in a lot of ways. And how do you feel about that? How do you justify building technology that enables bad activity? And more often than not, I say, like, one, it's a balance. Like, there, you need to keep that in mind. Like, you should be ethically aware of what you're enabling. There are also a tremendous amount of good things that we're enabling by adding privacy because you're giving people a lot of opportunity that they currently don't have. We can go into that in a moment. But like this, like, how do you view the ethics of building technology and whether or not technology in itself is neutral?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I think it's a valid point as well, right? But one way to view this is that the universe itself, or like the reality that we live in, is fairly agnostic to our own actions. It allows anything to happen, and then more within, you know, physical constraints. And that allows for sort of bad actors to, you know, quote unquote bad actors to do something. But if that's in of itself, you know, imposing good or bad is a matter of perspective. And the closer that we can kind of get to that reality for allowing ourselves to create our sort of artificial constructions on top of, the better, right? In terms of humanity as a superorganism going in whatever trajectory we want the civilization to go in, right? Now, that doesn't prevent, at the same time, like, there's kind of an issue with the, you know, modern nation, like, there's a lot of issues with modern nation states, but one of them is this sort of a rising of an order in conjunction with a government and its law, right? Like, all of these were effectively monolithic and bundled together. Whereas I think you can actually tease out the sort of order aspect of that while having a plurality of different governments on top of that. And also, you know, what is a notion of autocentric law, right? So like a plurality of different sort of courts or however you want to conduct yourself. But then on the sort of like, you know, notion of like terrorism per se, like I forget the exact quote by like Glenn Greenwald, but he was saying something to the effect that, you know, like terrorism is a term that, you know, means nothing, but like induces fear in everybody. And like, he was basically talking about like justifying deceptive actions or achieving consent around a public policy by invoking this notion of terrorism. But even in terrorism, then like the amount of deaths that are a result of terrorism is like, you're more likely to be killed by a vending machine or something, right? And the even notion of terrorism takes on the perspective of who is actually calling somebody a terrorist, right? Whereas like that other side of the that other side has real reasons of why they are doing whatever they're doing. And I think it's more of a social problem that needs to be addressed rather than something that you can embed in the technology. Maybe a more concrete example of that is they like attempts at censorship. Like, you can knock out somebody's sort of social network, but they can always create a new account. There's always ways to kind of circumvent it. So this sort of like suppression or regulation only creates externalities to governance. And if you can kind of bring everybody on the same page, at least that kind of allows you to form agreements, at least the option to form agreements with actors that you might not agree with. And maybe that's not a satisfactory answer. And I think we definitely need to spend more time working on that. But I generally look at humanity as a whole rather than when it comes to this specific part, rather My than side. Take a perspective.
Yeah, this is to most typically my answer too. It's so to lay out my personal beliefs of the ethics on technology or ethics of building technology is that technology itself is a tool and is inherently neutral. It does have constraints on how it can be used, which are usually shaped by the people who build it in the first place, because there is an underlying motive or politics or ethics associated with the technology being built. Like, we are out to build this thing for this reason, to serve this purpose, right? That in itself has a level of bias, and we'd like it used in this way in order to keep people, like, in order to make sure it's used this way, we try and attract these other use cases outside of it. That being said, you can't always force a specific use case, especially in our circumstances. If you're optimizing for inclusion, you want to involve as many people as possible with as many opinions on how to use the technology as possible. And so, like, when you have this upfront ethics and motivation for building technology, which shapes the technology itself, what we're trying to do in our ethics is very much optimize for inclusion and since you're SIP resistant and like asymmetric power dynamics. So like few people can't control the large amount, which is what we have today. When you do that, on the other side, there's going to be a lot of people who use the technology in ways in which you don't want them to. And, or like you didn't set out to do, because you're optimizing for inclusion in a lot of ways. And my rebuttal for people who say you're enabling a lot of bad people or bad actions that you can't stop because you can't censor them, or it's that their actions are not transparent, is the technology will be built for sure. Like the cat's out of the bag. We have privacy technology, zero knowledge, like cryptography is like in full swing, growing quickly. Quality, scalable consensus is being developed such that we can use it on a world scale. Like this stuff will continue to grow and the cat's out of the bag. I would rather the people with strong ethics and morals build it and be the experts in how they work than those with these more quote unquote maligned desires. Specifically because when you'd like to root those people out, you're able to help work with governments or people who want to do this with you in such a way where you say these options are no longer available to you, and help figure out alternative ways to get those people to stop doing these actions. And when you agree with them, then provide backdoors, because we've all seen backdoors and things like encryption just simply don't work. Like it ruins the entire system in itself. And that's always been a very difficult thing for people to understand, is that these things will grow. This technology will remove the current ridiculous power asymmetry in the internet today. Law enforcement or people who don't like this activity need to figure out how to do is find alternative means to stop that behavior, to stop relying on the power asymmetry to do it. And so when people ask me, why do you build this stuff, is because I am ethical. I care about these things. I consider myself a moral person. I'd rather be the expert that can help mitigate activity than be the non-expert with morals trying to catch up to the bad activity to figure out how it works. And also the problems are interesting to me, but like out of the two situations, which in my opinion, it's not a false dichotomy, like you would always want the people with morals to be the experts so that they can react to the situation faster than not.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the argument, like, I mean, if you kind of zoom out as well, like the argument doesn't hold either, because if you look at, like I said, the majority of bad actors, far more value flows through corrupt politicians and the financial elite. Say like first aid going to different countries often doesn't get to where it was intended to go, because everyone's taking a slice of that and then hiding it within banks and these sort of things. Plus, you have intelligence agencies running like mass drug operations, and they're using the US dollar for doing that. In terms of like stopping corruption or bad actors, the current system is it's demonstrably already here. Like it's not actually solved in any way. There are abilities to, and there's certainly efforts to kind of control certain aspects of smaller entities, but when it comes to the big stuff, like all of that's still happening. And it comes at the cost of like eroding the civil liberties of almost everyone on the planet. And the other side of this is like, I generally think that the value created by this sort of like new political system that could arise out of this technology is going to be far greater in terms of like what we already have today. So there was a paper that came out from the Copenhagen Consensus that was showing that like a mere 0.1% reduction in transaction costs literally quadruples a country's wealth, right? The difference between, say, like Argentina and Switzerland. There was a report that came out by World Bank in 2006 talking about, I think, where is the wealth of nations, something like this. where we were talking about, where it basically outlined that the rule of law and the capacity to socially coordinate outweighs even extraction of natural resources, right? So if you can create a technology that allows people to socially coordinate in with, like, say, stable corruption-resistant, censorship-resistant institutions.
I want to hold off and start over with the car alarm there, or the ambulance there.
Very audible.
So, I mean, the producer found the quote that I was talking about from Glenn Greenwald, which was, terrorism means nothing other than what the U.S. government wants it to mean at any given moment.
That's kind of this, like, general subjective thought. Like, it is a weaponized term. Now, I agree that there is such a thing as terrorism, but it's always going to be a subjective thing because I belong to a group and I have a specific set of ideals and people are out trying to attack those ideals, right? But that's very much, that conversation can be flipped and it's very subjective, right? Like you can agree with it, but you can only agree with it if you concede that you are a part of a group with an enemy.
Right. And that also kind of speaks to how, like, this technology works anyway. Like, I don't think that the tech is inherently neutral. Like, you see different ideologies rising up around, say, Bitcoin and Ethereum. I would say that broadly speaking, Ethereum is fairly modern liberal, whereas Bitcoin has a very strong sort of laissez-faire libertarian streak to it.
Yeah, but that's not the tech. That's not the tech. The group of people who wield it.
True, but I mean, the people at the end of the day, who is writing the code, right? Like,
that's what I mean, right? That's the interesting thing here is that, like, you have a set of politics in the development of a piece of technology, and you have the technology itself, which is constrained partially by the people who build it, and then you have this cut of the moment the technology exists and is able to be used by anyone or people outside of the people who built it, there's a difference in politics from there because it's wielded in different ways based on who's using it. And there's this kind of, there's an influence of how it's built and how it's used and how its use then changes the way it's built to further course correct into the way in which people think it's supposed to be done. But ultimately the tech itself is neutral. Because you have this break. Like, if it was continuous and it was only being able to be used in the way in which it was supposed to be, then I could probably agree with you that technology is political. But, like, ultimately speaking, it's like this point of break between it being built and being used, in my opinion, makes it neutral. And you have to think about the groups of people building things and why they build it and the groups of people who use it and how it gets used. But, like, you can never blame the tech. I mean, so, like, if you go after the technology in order to try and stop the behavior, then you're ultimately doing it wrong. And that's the problem that I have, because people focus on the politics of the technology and it being the problem versus the people who are doing it.
I mean, that's definitely true. Like, I think that people tend to look at material artifacts and then try and change them, right? So, you know, the rise of sort of hate speech, the introduction of hate speech laws right now is, like, they're looking at law as a material tool, yet they're trying to create laws that are inherently subjective. And that never works because it's completely open to interpretation. However, I find it very hard to separate both of those, right? Like, I guess I take a Marshall McLuhan stance, you know, the medium is message, or, like, you know, we create the technology and then the technology then creates us. And so with anything that we create, we're ultimately tied to it, culturally, sociologically, politically, economically. And there's this kind of back and forth on that front. But I tend to agree that, like, you know, censoring the technology itself is not going to be viable because it just pushes it, as I said, into, like, these externalities of governance, right? It goes into a realm where it's no longer under, you know, any kind of guidance.
Yeah, you put me in a bind here because I've been using that term for quite a while now in a lot of my talks. The medium is the message. Yeah. I think it's So like the art, we are subject to the artifacts we create mm-hmm. in terms of how we leverage them to make social communications and group together. I don't think the artifacts, the tools are political. It's just the only way we have, these are the things we have at our disposal to express ourselves. And the reason why we're building the technology we're building within like within Logos is specifically because the tools we think we need don't exist. And we have a politics or ethics associated with building something different because we've identified a problem with what currently exists.
Right. I mean, I get what you're saying. I definitely take a difference of opinion on that. Like, ultimately, you know, the technology we create is a calcification of like the thoughts that went into it. And so in order to create something that's inherently neutral, there needs to be a form of like, almost like a universal morality or a set of principles that guide that. I think a great example of this might be is EIP 4844, like the sort of precursors to dank sharding, proto dank sharding in Ethereum, where you know there was lobbying from large stake interests that ended up allowing for like history on the blockchain to be forgotten after like 2 weeks or something like this, mm-hmm. right? And this allows Ethereum to scale in terms of layer twos substantially more, right? But that becomes really problematic when you start thinking in terms of like what Jack Garrido calls, you know, this sort of cultural archive or, you know, the archive in general. And the archive matters because if you are able to take control over the archive in a society, then you can effectively, or its memory, you can rewrite its history. And then you can separate those people from their historical roots and their cultural identity and make new generations think something entirely different. And so when I see that he kind of wants this to sort of democratize access to the archive, right? Where anyone has the ability to read and effectively append to this immutable data store. And that's how I view blockchains and decentralized file storage to a large extent. And once you start chipping away at that, then you open the historical record to a lot more subjective interpretation, which can lead to these formations of power that end up rewriting an entire society's sort of history and like who they think they are. So
here's the problem.
Like the technology itself is obviously static in that to a certain extent, but at the same time, it's a calcification of the ideas that went into it. And if they're not enforced, it'll ultimately change as well, right? Like at the end of the day, it's just code.
The issue that I have with this is the moment you, because there's this stark change, a step function, whatever you want to call it, between the ethics of building, what goes in, like this calcification of ideals, right? If you want to call it that. I think it's a good way of putting it. Technology is a calcification of ideals. And then its application, which is different because you can't fully constrain a use of a technology with the ideals you set out to have it being used, is when it's used in a manner that is considered bad, and you make this distinct connection between its use and its creation, then you're able to justify its bad use to attack the people who are building it.
Yeah.
If you have this stark change, it's more difficult to do that. And I think that's very important, as you've made a differentiation between the group of people who are out to do something and their motivation, and the group of people who are using something for alternative motivations. And that's a very important distinction to make, especially when you look at what we've seen happen in with like, you know, and throughout the history of technology used this way, whether it be nuclear technology, encryption, blockchains, private blockchains or privacy technology, right? There's always this justification of the behavior and trying to mitigate the behavior of its use and not being able to go after specific people because they don't have the information. So they go after the people who created it in the first place, which isn't fair.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, that's like going after gun manufacturers because those guns were sold by some arms dealer to wherever, and then like some conflict arise where people died, right?
That's a great analogy, right? That's perfect. Yeah.
I mean, but just look at like the crypto wars as well, right? Like SSL and like all of that encryption technology was, you know, severely banned in many ways, and had to be printed on t-shirts just to, you know, under freedom of speech to kind of get the word out. But now it secures like almost every web request that you make, and certainly so with your bank or whenever you're making a purchase online. So the inverse of that would be to expose all of those transactions and make people vulnerable, which is exactly what's happening in blockchains right now. Like everyone's account balance is completely open in these, and like blockchain forensics companies have come up to kind of solve that. And there's an issue with that when it comes to proprietary algorithms and non-open solutions to trying to trace funds is introduced into law, because it's basically his or her opinion at that point. But like people have an expectation of privacy around their bank account. Why wouldn't they have an expectation of privacy for their effective equivalent of or analogous equivalent of a bank account on whatever their favorite public program or blockchain is?
I definitely agree with that. People don't also realize that they're beholden to their bank account, and they're not beholden to anyone with a blockchain. And so banks don't like that versus people. Right. And just like the SSL or TLS implementation of the internet, like you can't have commerce, real commerce, unless you provide that privacy, because there's a bunch of assholes out there and they'll take your money. Especially when you build an open system where access to information is ubiquitous, the ability to do that is much harsher. So the level of privacy required to actually enable commerce is much greater. Like real commerce. Yeah. We could probably go around these topics forever. We often do. But I wanted to at least talk about like, what are we doing? Like what's the point of Logos and what we're setting out to do, and like how is it made up?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I think like Logos is an attempt to establish like a new polity for me, right? Like there are multiple markers that show that the way that we currently are socially organized and is not particularly working very well. Say like the Freedom House Index is showing that freedom in almost all nation states is like steadily declining, certainly over the past sort of 20 years. And at the same time, you know, that there's issues with the way that we say do democracy, there's the ways that we do, and just nation states in general in terms of like their legitimacy. So there's supposed to be this notion of consent or consent of the governed. Yet when you actually dive down into consent, most people haven't expressed their consent for governance, right? So it's like in the US Constitution, you haven't actually signed that.
Just born.
Yeah, you're just kind of born into it. And then there's like notions of sovereign immunity or governmental immunity, which absolves the actual government exempt from civil liability. Like in the case of the United States, like I think it was 1821, Collins versus Virginia, the Supreme Court ended up implying that the government could not be sued if it didn't consent. And from then has expanded to over 20 million public servants and different bodies of government being effectively exempt from civil liabilities, right? And so it really comes back to this this notion of like, okay, you want to kind of protect sort of civil liberties, this notion of political neutrality is a prerequisite for that. But at the same time, in order to maintain this notion of political neutrality, you also need sovereignty in that system against any bias or coercion. And this kind of brings you to this sort of latent cypherpunk dream, which Balaji is kind of popularizing as a noic state, right? But it's an older idea that kind of has been around for a while in different incarnations, but certainly in the 2000s with Jerry Everett's virtual states or the various essays of crypto-anarchists in crypto-anarchy, cyberstates, and pirate utopias, is this idea of effectively creating independence in cyberspace, right, or territorialization of cyberspace. And that might sound really far-fetched at first glance, but I forget exactly when, but the Department of Defense officially recognized cyberspace as a domain of conflict, up there with, you know, land, air, sea, and space. The UN has recognized this sort of the sovereignty over partitions of cyberspace, as well as many nations are also, you know, certainly China, want to uphold their sovereignty in cyberspace, right? Yet it is probably one of the only frontiers that are left that also allows you to deploy governing services globally around the entire planet, mm-hmm. And cheaply, right? So if you can create like a system which upholds its own notion of sovereignty in the technology stack itself or in its infrastructure, then you are effectively challenging sovereignty of nations over their partition of cyberspace, and you're protecting the citizens that are participating in it. But and if you can do that for what against, say, like against one nation state, then you most likely can do it for all. And that becomes really interesting on, say, the world stage, where like it's arguably the only real anarchical society between sovereigns. You know, various nations are capable of defending themselves. Which becomes super fascinating for, say, like a rules-based order. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm kind of going on a bit of a tangent here, but like in order to make some of these ideas realized, like there needs to be a technology stack that upholds these sort of set of principles or ideals and understands why they matter and encodes those into the technology.
I think that's a great way of framing it, right? It's like, what are the requirements for that ever existing? All right, so how do we build technology that upholds those requirements or meets those requirements? And that's ultimately what we're setting out to do, is build something that allows for that to emergently happen. I think.
Right.
I mean, we have our own motivations for leveraging this technology to build things, but ultimately speaking, like it's free and open for everyone to use. So if we fail, someone else can do it, or if someone does it better, they can do it. And I think that's like, this happening emergently, like how do you build technology that allows for that to happen emergently such that it's not dependent upon our specific success for it to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, why free culture movement matters and open source matters, and then documenting everything and making it public. So like if we fail, then if someone wants to carry on the experiment and sees the value in that, then they can as well.
Or if they have some alternative idea on what those requirements are, they can take it and fork off and make their own version of it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, like, I guess for us, that instantiation is, at least for now, three projects, namely Waku, Codex, and Nomos. Can you walk us through those?
Yes. I mean, like, Nomos, I guess, is our, you know, quote-unquote layer one agreements layer that intends to uphold sort of privacy on the sort of network level, as well as on the validator level and on the sort of transactional level, right? So like private smart contracts. Codex is a decentralized file storage system. This is necessary for holding, you know, larger cultural archive records, you know, such as blockchain state, for example. And Waku is decentralized peer-to-peer private messaging framework that allows people to communicate without worrying about a global adversary.
Yeah, that's like ostensibly that's the same three pillars that Ethereum came out with. Like you need storage, execution and agreement, and then ephemeral messaging in order to build anything that is reasonably censorship resistant and decentralized, right? I hate the term decentralized. It's a means to an end. But like censorship resistance and privacy is the main, I think, focus for me as someone more focused on the technology side of things. And you do whatever is appropriate to get to those things that allows for efficient and like usable experience.
Yeah. Those three protocols allow you to then create a necessary for a decentralized technology stack to create a whole wide range of institutions of decentralized applications, and in turn builds out the economy and the governance of this, our instantiation of a network state.
We'll be coming out with probably a lot more in terms of things you can dig your hands into, but I'm a good portion of the technology building side of this, and I'd say you're more of the political motivation, ethics. This is why we're doing this. This is the problem that we see instead of doing this. Would you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely some overlap there, but
yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah. Awesome. That was fun. Anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap up?
Not without going down a rabbit hole. So I think that's good.